Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Do you want to give a little intro and say hi? And
Hi, yeah. I would just ask, I assume all of you have seen the episodes?
Yeah.
No.
I would just really ask you to do us a favor and not give away the details of the fate of Lafayette until the show airs.
Okay, so Alan, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to kind of call upon people one at a time in the order in which they logged on. So Tracy, Fancast, you're first up.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely.
You mentioned in another interview that this season is just going to be more of everything, and the show is already incredibly sexy and gory. So what can you tell us what more we can look forward to? Since it's already a lot.
Believe it or not, the show is sexier and gorier. I think it's also funnier. I think it's also deeper. I just feel like the show is really finding its identity and settling into itself in a way that feels really organic to me. And it definitely feels to me as if things are ramped up for season two.
Yeah. And for those who haven't read the books, I mean, last season the story was about, you know, a serial killer. This year it's about a mysterious creature. Is each chapter or season going to be a different mystery, or?
Well, you know, we are basing the show on source material, a very, very successful line of novels by Harris. And there is an element of mystery in each book, pretty much. But it's more than just that. That's just part of the mix. There's also a love story. There's also, you know, horror. There's also things that are funny. I wouldn't say that each season revolves around a mystery, because, for example, in the first season, we, the audience, did not know who the serial killer was. And we were sort of trying to figure it out at the same time Sookie was trying to figure it out. In this season, as the show progresses, we know that there is a character who is really up to no good and who is dangerous long before any of the other characters on the show know it. So it's a little bit of a flip in that regard.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Noelle from Star Pulse, you'll be next.
Hi, I was wondering if you could tell us how you feel about Anna and Steven's real-life romance and how that affects filming and what's going on there.
They are such consummate professionals, both of them, that it doesn't affect filming whatsoever. It only affects filming in the sense that they're incredibly comfortable with each other and their personality translates to the screen. And I'm very happy for both of them. They're both terrific people, and they really found somebody, you know, that they found somebody that they really want to be with, and I, you know, there's nothing negative about it.
Daniel, Hitfix?
Hey, thank you so much for doing this call. I guess I want to ask, given just how dedicated and passionate the fan base is there any concern to the subplot involving the cult and sort of how that reflects on zealotry?
No, that never even crossed my mind prior to you asking that question. I really don't think the fan. Actually, there are two cults in the show this year. Which one are you talking about?
The main anti-vampire cult.
Oh, okay. No, because I don't think vampire fans are going to associate themselves with anti-vampire zealots.
I mean, I think you could also talk about Marianne's cult and sort of how that plays into people who are so overwhelmed by pleasure that they sort of give up to everything else.
I think people who are overwhelmed by pleasure will love this show. I don't think anybody's going to – the kind of people who would look at this and say, oh, that's – they're making fun of me and that's casting me in a bad light, or not really the kind of people who are going to be watching this show to begin with. They're going to be watching Fox News.
Well, okay, changing a little bit on that then, do you feel like the second is perhaps a little bit more sort of directly satirical because of the way it looks at the cult than the first season might have been in terms of sort of a political analysis of some sort?
I suppose it can look that way, having just seen the first four episodes, but it actually, it turns deadly serious. And that whole conflict becomes one that is deadly, deadly serious. I mean, certainly I think we did not set out to go, oh, let's make a more satirical show this year. And again, I'm basing it on source material. However, you know, given the sort of nature of the political debate in this country, I think it's very easy to look at it and see it in a satirical light. But I you know, have been very clear from the beginning with all the actors and with the actors playing Stephen Ferris specifically is that they really believe what they're doing. They really, really believe that they, you know, they have a mission to save the world.
Okay, Sandy from Damon TV.
Thank you. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for doing this today. My question is more about your process as far as writing the episodes. How do you come up with the story for each episode, and is it mostly based on the book, or you know, do you kind of invent some new things just to go with what you want to do with the show?
Well, I think it's probably like a 50-50 combo, using material from the book and coming up with stuff on our own. The books are all narrated by Sookie, so the books are basically Sookie's story. And the other characters really only exist in the books when they're in the room with Sookie. So we stick pretty closely to the Sookie story. We do make some changes here and there that just feel, you know, help streamline the story or work better in a visual medium as opposed to, you know, the center page. But we also, you know, a lot of the storyline is original. However, we do try to make sure that it stays remain true to the spirit of the book. We start each season with a book, and we sort of go through and we say these are the great moments that we really want to hang on to, and then we spread it out over 12 episodes, and then we start filling in the blanks with the other characters. And then I work with four really great writers that I would like to actually name them, Brian Buckner, Nancy Oliver, Ryle Tucker, and Alexander Wu, because they are as much a part of the storytelling of the show as I am. Then it just becomes kind of like an organic collaboration.
Okay, Emma from Fanbolt.
Hi, Ellen. I'm a big fan of the series and of the books as well, and I was wondering if you've actually read all the books and how close you plan for the series to ultimately follow the books in the bigger picture.
I have not read the newest book that was just released because I haven't had time. I fell in love with these books, and I thought this is a great tale and this is a great universe, and I think one of the reasons the books are so successful is that they work. Honestly, I think probably as the series progresses, we will be forced to, you know, not. You're walking a fine line. You want to be as faithful to the books as possible, but at the same time, you don't subscribe, because then there will be no surprises for the audience. But I definitely intend to be, you know, very faithful to the source material because it's really good. And it worked.
Sarah from FearNet.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good, good. Just to go back for a second to the kind of gore and sexiness of the show, did you feel you had to up the ante this season? And did you draw on any specific horror or sci-fi influences other than Charlene's books?
I did not feel like we needed to up the ante, just to up the ante.
Okay.
I did feel like it was important to make Eric more frightening, to make him more of a, to see his more monstrous side, because as the season progresses, we definitely also see his more human side. I personally, you know, that there's a scene where Sookie and Bill make love in the first episode that basically on the page it said, you know, Sookie and Bill make love. And then I saw the dailies and I saw the scene cut together and I wasn't there when they shot it and I just kind of went, oh, wow, okay. But, you know, I love it. I think that's part of what the appeal of the show is. I don't think any, I don't think we do anything gratuitously, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's important to show that, you know, between Sidney and Bill, there is this incredible erotic chemistry. These are two people who thought that they had no chance to ever have a real love affair, and they found each other. And there's something fantastic and you know, mind-blowing about that. For example, the violence in the first few episodes, it's important to see that these people are monsters. Vampires are capable of being monsters. I don't mean to say they are monsters, but they are capable of being monsters and violent. And it was also important to have the character who will remain nameless, who has to deal with all that, to sort of suffer from, you know, a kind of PTSD over the course of the season. Because you don't want to just have all that horrible gore and what an awful psychological experience for him, and then just have him be okay the next day.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way it happens in real life.
I mean, you really explore, like, different aspects of evil in people and also in the undead. Can you pinpoint one character this season that you would say is the most evil of all?
The most evil?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I don't think people who are actually evil know they're evil or believe that they're evil. I think they believe in some way that their actions are justified.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hesitate to say Marianne is the most evil, although she definitely is, she revels in chaos and destruction, but from a sort of, she doesn't look at it from the polarities of good and evil. She's got a different, more ancient perspective. But just in terms of someone who just really kind of enjoys being cruel and sadistic and has a really dark vision, it's a character that has not shown up yet.
Okay.
It's another vampire from Dallas.
Okay, Liz from true-blood.net.
Hi, Liz.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Happy to talk to you again.
Yeah, me too.
We're pretty excited about season two, obviously, and I am spoiler-free. I have not seen the first four episodes, so yay me.
Okay.
I know the new season takes place mostly in Dallas. How is that going to be reflected in the look of the show as far as costume, art, set design, things like that?
Well, it definitely is a different look than Bon Temps, and I would correct you. Most of the... A part of the show takes place in Dallas, but not most of the show. There's a lot of stuff still going on in Bon Temps.
Okay.
But definitely we chose to, show a very different side of vampire culture, and that's kind of like sophisticated vampire culture in the big city. You know, a lot of the show takes place in a hotel that caters specifically to vampires, and it's very, very upscale. We definitely, it's a different look in Dallas when we're in the city, but then a lot of it takes place at the Fellowship of the Sun has a leadership conference that takes place on a campground that they own. So that's still fairly nature-based and rural.
What about,
What
about the music this season? Is that also going to change? Have you stumbled upon a new favorite for yourself?
What do you mean, new favorite?
A new favorite band or song from this next season.
Very excited that we've been using a song from the new Bob Dylan album called "Beyond Here Lies Nothing," and we've been using that for all of our promos, and we definitely will use that in the last episode. When we go to Dallas and we go to the hotel, it's definitely it's a different kind of music than what you hear in Merlot. It's more, you know, sort of urban, sophisticated, definitely different. We use a lot of different music in the show. I will say that there are some moments where the show goes back in time to visit some of our characters during earlier parts of their lives. And since we have some characters who are hundreds of years old, that's a very different time. But generally, the music, it's still pretty Louisiana-based, aside from the upscale hotel music when they get to Dallas.
Okay, Jim, Futon Critic.
Hey, Jim.
Hi there. Hey, hi there. Hey, Toby, real quick, I hear somebody typing, and I'm having a hard time hearing Alan. Is there somebody who can mute their phone?
Does everybody hear that comment? Can somebody, whoever's typing, maybe mute the phone?
Okay, Thank you. Sorry about that, Alan.
No problem.
Loving the new episode so far. I have a question. You know, with Sookie and Bill's relationship kind of being the core of the show, how do you keep the complications seem natural and not just contrive to keep them, you know, apart or at least complicated? How do you do that as a writer?
Well, given the source material, there's a lot going on. They, you know, this year Sookie goes to Dallas to help Eric find this missing vampire. And, you know, ultimately, if we actually broke down the timeline of the entire season, and season two takes place in 12 days.
Okay.
And when a lot of that time is spent running for your lives or trying not to get killed or trying to get past this or that obstacle that keeps you from each other, it's not really hard. You know, they don't really have time to start to run into the same kind of relationship things that, you know, us mere mortals do. It's like, yeah, I really hate it when you do that. And, you know, I wish you would, you know, that kind of thing. They're basically trying to just get through the day without getting killed.
Okay. And you know, now that the show's kind of a bona fide hit, are you feeling more pressure or less pressure just since that at least you know the show's a hit?
I don't really think about those things. I feel like that is a real trap because I just really try to do the best work that I can do and stay out of the results. I'm glad people are watching the show. I always thought that it was a show that a lot of people would have fun with. But I don't feel more pressure, and I really work very hard to try to stay in a little bubble in that regard, because otherwise you just go crazy. It doesn't help.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Tara from Newsarama.
Hi, Alan. Thanks so much for doing this with us today.
Absolutely.
I want to talk a little bit about the characters like Tara and Jessica that really weren't a part of the book, per se. And you've just done such a wonderful job kind of weaving in all of these disparate stories with this ensemble. What are some of the things that you're trying to explore with the characters that you're straying from what the book did? What do you want to explore with those kinds of characters?
Again, my process and the process that we work with in the room is very organic. So we never set out and say, okay, we want to explore this, so let's create a character in which we can explore that.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly Tara does exist in the books, but she's not
right.
African-American, and she doesn't show up until season two.
Right. Less minor.
You know, thinking about Tara, I did think, well, we need another strong woman who is one of our core group of characters. And, you know, I think it's Louisiana. Let's explore the sort of, you know, racial makeup of that region. And also, this is a small town in the South in Louisiana where they still do things like, you know, hang nooses from trees at high schools, you know, and that's based on racial tension. I think it would be silly to do a show set in a small town in Louisiana and just have Caucasian characters.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted Tara to be... Tara, definitely in the book, she does have an alcoholic mother, and she
right.
was Sookie's friend, but I wanted, you know, to really explore a really strong friendship of two kind of outcasts.
Yeah.
And then Jessica... Once we decided to make Bill the guy who stakes Long Shadow instead of Eric, which is the way it is in the book, it just felt like it would be really interesting for him to have to do something that he has never, ever wanted to do. The worst punishment for him would be to have to turn someone else into a vampire, because for him that was the biggest tragedy of his life. And then once we had a girl who came from a very sheltered homeschooled background and plucked her out of that and put her in this entirely new environment with entirely new powers, that just opened itself up to all kinds of interesting situations, I think.
Great, thank you.
Liliana from Mania.com.
Yes. Hi. I'm a really big fan of the show and the books. And the question I had was, I once read an interview where you said that early in your TV writing career, you didn't really have an emotional connection with what you were writing. So I was wondering, what kind of emotional connection do you have with True Blood?
Well, certainly, the thing about True Blood, the emotional connection is that it is so much fun. It is so much fun to work on, and it's such a fun story. And I feel for all of these characters. They feel like, you know, they feel real to me, which may be a subtle form of madness, and if it is, so be it. But, you know, when we're breaking stories, we might as well have a sign in the writer's room that says it's the emotion that's stupid. Because if you don't have characters that you care about and you can't base their behavior in their own emotional needs, then it's just a parade of set pieces and special effects. And I personally do not respond to that kind of entertainment. I feel like what makes the show special is it has all the trappings of an amusement park, you know, ride, fun thrill ride, but at the same time, characters are behaving the way they're behaving from an organic emotional place, you know, as much as one can in a show about vampires. But I think it's really important to keep it rooted in the character's desires and wants and needs and struggles and disappointments and not just in, oh, fangs, special effects, werewolves, blah, blah, blah. Ultimately, that stuff on its own, I don't think is that interesting.
Right. Great. Thank you.
Tim from TV.com.
Hey, Alan. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely.
Your last show, 6 Feet Under, was a regular at award shows, and I was wondering if you think True Blood will follow that, and if you think it will have a more difficult time because it's a genre show?
I don't really think about those things. Those things just, I think there is, I'm sorry, can you hold on 1 second? I have to let the dog out. I'll be right back. Sorry about that. You know, the award show stuff, fun, it's nice, it's like being prom king. Ultimately, it's not what it's all about. I think there are many, many, I just really don't think about it that much. Not that invested in it. I've been very fortunate in that I have won a bunch of awards more than I ever thought I would, and I've got a shelf at home with them all on it, and I sort of feel like I personally don't ever need to win another award. It's just, I would rather work on something that I really, really love and enjoy.
Yeah. Can you talk about maybe the process of going from a regular drama to the genre, Kat? Or is it kind of the same writing process for you, or do things open up a little bit more?
Well, in a lot of ways, the process is the same. Certainly the way that I put shows together with writers and with all the people that I work with is very much the same. I think, 6 Feet Under was a very personal show. It was also as great an experience as it was, and I loved every moment of making that show, and it was a tremendous personal and professional achievement for me that I'm very proud of. But it was hard. You know, 5 years of staring into the abyss was kind of, it took its toll. And I think, you know, I think that's one of the things that really appealed to me about Charlene's books when I was reading them. It was like, man, this is so much fun, and I can't keep it down. And it's really, it has an emotional basis, but it's also just crazy fun. And I think that's just kind of what I wanted to do, something different. I don't want to do 6 Feet Under over again.
Yeah.
I remember when I wrote American Beauty, I suddenly got offered every midlife crisis movie that was in development. And I just sort of thought, well, why are you giving me this? I did this. I don't want to go through life repeating myself. What fun is that?
All right, awesome. Thank you very much.
Sure. Rachel from Buzz Sugar.
Hi, Alan. Hi. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about Jason's character and his arc for the season.
Jason in the books is very much, you know, the hot guy in town who basically is a total womanizer. And I think, you know, once we started to flesh him out, no pun intended, we started looking at him as, you know, he's sexually compulsive. And what is that about? What is he hiding from? And ultimately, at his core, Jason is a scared little boy who's been abandoned by everybody he's ever loved. So it was fun playing the sort of, you know, Lothario, horn dog aspect of Jason and his, and then getting him involved in an addiction storyline, and then also having him fall in love, or what he assumed was love, you know, given that he was mostly high out of his mind all the time, and then losing the woman that he loved. Then in the second season, I think he really is very much aware of a kind of deep hole that he has kind of in the center of his soul, and he's looking for something to fill that. And, you know, as many people do, he latches onto religion. And he goes and he becomes part of this organization that makes him feel special, makes him feel like he's really good and gifted at something. And that really means a lot to him. But, of course, you know, as time goes on, he's going to realize that not only is the organization that he's involved with kind of, you know, not really, doesn't really have anything to do with the fundamental message of Jesus, but also that it's, you know, there's going to be a lot of, let's just say Jason can't keep his clothes on too long.
I was going to ask if he was going to be more buttoned up this season.
But definitely we're trying to explore something about Jason's character as opposed to just, you know, giving Ryan a, you know, just having him, you know, have the revolving door of sexual experiences, because he's sort of done that.
Right. Thank you.
Sure.
Got Cassandra from TrueBloodNet.com.
Hey, Cassandra.
Hi, Alan. Thank you so much for the phone call, and thank you so much for True Blood.
Oh, you.
I was wondering, when you're writing the episodes, do you always know where you want to go with them, or do they ever surprise you and take you to a new conclusion than you thought you were going to go to?
You know what happens is we break the entire season at the beginning of our process, and then we outline maybe the first 6 episodes, and we send people off to write them, and they come back in, and then it seems like the last 6 episodes, it always, by that point, the show is sort of becoming what it wants to be for that season, and so you end up making changes. You end up sort of re-breaking the last 6 episodes because of that. And certainly there are things that do surprise me. I know when I have an episode of my own to write, sometimes the scene will be about one particular thing in the outline, but then when I'm actually in the script itself, it sort of takes a little turn and becomes something else. And I just feel like that's part of the process. And when the other writers I work with, when that happens to them as well, I totally respect it.
Okay, great. And just one quick question that we ask everybody. Has your involvement in True Blood had an effect on how you think about good and evil?
I tend to think that good and evil are sort of like black and white polarities that we sort of turn to in a very, very gray world. So I think that's sort of reflected in the show, so I don't think it's changed. It certainly hasn't changed the way I look at good and evil. I certainly see good and evil in, my perceptions of good and evil in day-to-day life, and certainly in, you know, the 24-hour cable news cycle. I will say, you know, there's a moment in the second episode where Jason's at the church and they're being greeted by the Newlands, and somebody in the audience yells out, "Die, Fanger." Well, I would be lying if I didn't say some of the reactions of people at some of the Sarah Palin rallies of last fall wasn't behind that. You know?
Yep. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Shadaliza from The Vault.
Hi.
Yes. Hello, Ellen.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I haven't seen the first episode yet. I am completely in the dark.
Oh, okay.
I forgot to ask you. Charlene Harris left the backstories of Bill and Eric practically untouched in her books. But in season two, we will learn more about their past. What can you tell us about that?
I can't really tell you anything about it because I can't give it away. Certainly, Bill has been alive since, 1830-something. So we have 170 years that we can explore. We definitely will see more about, we saw Bill's transition to vampire in a flashback last season. We will definitely see Eric's, we'll see some parts of his life that are very interesting and some parts of Bill's life that are very interesting. But I can't really tell you more than that because I don't want to give anything away.
Thank you.
I think that's fair enough. I think we have about 20 minutes, 25 minutes left. We'll open it up wide for anybody who has follow-up questions.
Hi, this is Noelle again from StarPulse.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm probably in the minority here, but I actually read the first book from Charlene, and I didn't really like it that much. I love it. I love the series, though, completely. And so I'm curious about Evan Rachel Wood's role. I don't know if she was part of the book, her character was part of the book as well as your series, or if they're different, and what is she going to be doing? What's going on with that?
She is going to be playing I think her name is Sophiana Leclerc, and she is the Vampire Queen of Louisiana. The vampire political structure in the states is that each state has a king or queen. And they're sort of like the buck stops there in terms of vampire politics. She does exist in the book. She doesn't really show up until the fifth or sixth book. But it turned out that it made sense for her to show up in the second season. And I had actually gotten a call from Evan's manager last year during season one saying she loved the show and she would love to do it sometime. And I thought, great, if we find a role that really fits, that she fits, we'll definitely make that happen. And when we decided to actually have the queen appear in season two, that was the first person that came to mind. Because in the book, she is a young woman, a young-looking woman. She's more than 400 years old. Evan's really beautiful, and she's very, very pale and beautiful, and she looks like a vampire to me.
Have you started shooting her episode yet?
We have started shooting the episode. We haven't shot her in it, but I've definitely seen photos from her, from her costume fittings, and I think she's going to be really, really fantastic.
Great.
Hey, this is Emma from Fanbolt. I was wondering what you guys are going to be doing with Comic-Con this year.
We're going. We are going to have a panel discussion. I believe it's going to be, I think Charlene might be there. I think she's going, I'm not sure, but I know I'll be there, and Anna and Steven and Ryan and Sam and Rutina, and I believe Alexander Skarsgård will be there, and Deborah Ann Wall, who plays Jessica, and I think Michelle Ford.
Awesome. Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, this is Cassandra from TrueBloodNet.com, and we were wondering, what's the most difficult part you've had with creating True Blood at this point?
Trying to produce the show on a TV schedule and budget, and constantly, trying to fit those episodes are packed, and it's not just people sitting in the room talking. There's a lot of storyboarded action sequences, there are special effects sequences, there's a lot of big sequences in season two with lots of extras, and definitely the hardest part is just getting it done in time and not having the schedule and the budget just explode.
Thanks.
Sure.
Hey, Alan, it's Dan from HitFix. I remember back at the first TCA press tour session for the show, one of the things that you said was that you weren't sort of viewing vampirism as being a metaphor for anything else. Is that still the way you look at it?
I mean, it's very easy to look at the vampires and the way they exist in their struggle for assimilation and equal rights as a metaphor for, you know, gay and lesbians at this point in history, maybe African Americans 50 years ago. And, I think I would be naive if I didn't see that and see that was easy to sort of look at it that way. For me, it's a little too easy, and ultimately, one of the things I like about the show is that it is very complex because, I mean, you could look at it and say, like, well, if I'm using vampires, these murdering vicious monsters as metaphors for gay and lesbians, would I, as a gay man, really do that? I think, it sort of is very fluid, the metaphor in the show. And I certainly think, you know, one of the themes of the show is about how difficult it is to coexist with those who are other, with those who are different. But ultimately, we have to. But again, I can't take any of that stuff too seriously because, well, it's a show about vampires. You know?
Well, do you feel like you can sort of have it both ways? Because there's the Time magazine.
I think there's definitely something fun about that. There's definitely fun. You know, it's fun to create a prop, a Time magazine that says "Vampire Marriage Here to Stay."
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's not really the point of the show. I feel like it's this texture and detail that's kind of fun. And more than it being an actual comment on any specific struggle that's going on right now, it's more a way to try to make the show seem real. Because if vampires were out of the closet and they were, you know, struggling for rights, there would be that kind of thing going on.
Fair enough.
Any other questions?
I just have one more. This is Sandy from Damon's TV. I was wondering what your favorite episode in the season is so far.
In this season?
Yes.
Oh, that's really hard because I am really, really happy with season two. And you know, I watch these episodes probably 40 or 50 times, given the amount of time I spend in editing and post-production. And I really can't say I have a favorite episode. And I've only seen through episode 8.
Okay.
I have a rough cut of episode 9, but I haven't watched it yet. I just love the show. I actually love the fact that we had the premiere last week, and we showed episode 1 and 2 in a big theater with 500 people. And I have seen those episodes so many times, and I still just love them. You know, that is a huge, huge luxury for me because I've worked on shows in the past, not 6 Feet Under, but shows in the past where, ugh, do I have to watch this again? You know, and I've never had that feeling. With True Blood.
Okay. Thank you.
Alan, this is Liz again from true-blood.net. I was just wondering how far along, how many episodes have you filmed?
We are shooting episode 11 right now, and we start 12 next week.
And this is the one that you wrote, right?
I'm sorry?
Isn't this the one that you wrote?
11?
Yeah, you mentioned at Paley Fest.
Yeah, I wrote number 4 and number 11 this year.
Okay.
Yeah, and so we're shooting the episode that I wrote, which means I am the on-set writer-producer, and I was there till I guess around 11 o'clock last night, and I'll be going out to the location at 2 today. And I'll
okay, thank
you. 2 or 3 in the morning.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Liana from Mania.com.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question about how the actors and actresses in the show perfect their Southern accent. I know a lot of the lead characters are not from America, so I was wondering, do they work with a coach, or how do they do that?
We had a dialect coach for season one. We had a dialect coach available for most of season one, but this year they've all pretty much got it down.
Right.
I am from the South myself, so if I hear something that is really sounds off to me, I'll have them corrected in post, but they've all gotten really good at it.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Alan. It's Tara from Newsarama.
Hi.
Another question I wanted to ask was, you know, you're finishing up this season. Will you take a break and work on something else creatively during the hiatus? And then when will you go back into kind of working on arcing out season three?
I think what we are going to do is we're going to start arcing out season three while we're still in post. Mm-hmm. And then when we break for hiatus, I'm going to send out hopefully a batch of outline stories for people to start writing the scripts. And I think we're going to shoot one episode prior to the Christmas holidays so that we'll be a little bit ahead of the game next year, because right now we are scrambling to get everything done by the time it airs, those last few episodes. I don't really have time to go work on something else different during my hiatus. I need to sort of use the hiatus to sort of recharge and rest up. As you know, however, I do have a couple of projects in development at HBO, neither of which I wrote or came up with, but for which, you know, I'm serving as executive producer and sort of brought other writers and ideas into the network. And I also have a screenplay I wrote years ago, which is sort of in the vague process of putting itself together as a movie. But I would not direct that. I would produce it, and serve as screenwriter. But you know, my focus is True Blood. It has to be True Blood right now.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Alan. It's Sarah from fearnet.com.
Hi.
Hi. I was wondering, you are obviously a fan of Charlene's books. Was there anything in the second book or the third book that you were hoping would be included in the season that you just couldn't work in?
Actually, no. I mean, I'm in this sort of unique position of, like, if there's, you know, there are moments in the books that I just love, they're gonna be in the season.
Okay.
So my answer is no.
Okay, that's easy. Also, we have a question we like to ask everyone, which is, what's your greatest fear?
What's my greatest fear?
Uh-huh.
America turning into a fascist theocracy.
Thank you.
Hey, Alan, this is Tracy from Fancast again. Have you ever gotten any notes from HBO about the sex or violence?
Much?
Yeah.
No.
No. Okay.
No. I mean, I think, you know, honestly, we really do. It's there for a reason. It's there to tell a part of the story. It's not, you know, we're not like one of those Showtime After Hours shows where there's a vague plot that just is an excuse to put together a bunch of softcore sex scenes. We actually, I mean, the sex is in it. Sex is a very important part of people's psyches, and as you know, their sexuality is a way to explore who they are as characters. And I feel like that's always underlying everything that we do in the show.
It's also an important part of being a vampire. So,
yeah,
all right.
I mean,
well,
vampires kind of are sex.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
Hey, Alan. It's Tim from TV.com.
Hi.
I was wondering if, is Zelchko coming back?
He does not make an appearance in season two, but he is a character within the universe, and I think he probably will reappear at some point.
Okay, he should. He's awesome.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
If there are no more questions, I think we'll wrap it up and let Alan go back to work. Is that it? Well, Alan, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
Thank
you.
Thanks,
Alan.
And all the editors, we're going to send you an email giving you the playback information.
Great.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks, Alan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.